If you want to sell books and cause an argument, just take a position on the existence of God. Among the most successful titles in publishing over the past decade have been different sides of the God argument. Richard Dawkins, the late Christopher Hitchens, and Roger Penrose have all taken the position that God doesn't exist, science proves it, and that in any case, religion has been a profoundly destructive force in the world. To these titles add numerous pro-God, pro-spirituality, and anti-evolution books of one kind or another, and the battle is joined. This holy war of words tends to set up each writer as a kind of Galileo, preaching against some orthodoxy that will anger the faithful, the scientific, or everything in between. Mathematician Amir Axel has sliced this argument in a way that may anger all sides at once, and he's quite happy about that. His new book is titled Why Science Does Not Disprove God. Double negative there. In the current physics and math, he says there is more than enough mystery to support a spiritual outlook without throwing out a century of Einstein, quarks, and Higgs particles.
I think in my mind I make a distinction between two gods, the gods of organized religions and the god of Einstein, for example. And Einstein used to say things like, subtle is the Lord, but malicious he is not. You know, thinking of God as a kind of an abstraction of the god of Genesis, this old man with a beard who is not malicious but is cantankerous or something like that. And he said things like, I want to know God's thoughts, the rest are details. And to me, Einstein was, in a sense, a believer in some kind of a power behind the universe. And that's the God I'm trying to defend here, not the God of religions.
How do you distinguish between the God that has a consciousness, an intelligence of some kind, versus a God that signifies a creation moment, the idea that something was set in motion that brings us the universe that we live in right now? Those are two different notions of God, one that plans and designs, the other that just initiates a set of conditions.
Well, to me, it's a second God that I'm interested in. If you look at what happened in the first second of the universe, even a fraction of a second, suddenly there's this huge explosion. Well, an explosion doesn't really do anything. And then there's this mass creation through the Higgs. Why would there be creation of mass using the Higgs mechanism, which is so highly mathematical, so complicated? To me, that thought behind it, that's God. And then you have the quark soup that existed when mass was created. There are all these particles, and they're swimming in this plasma, which is, this weird fluid. Suddenly, they all bunch in threes. Two ups and a down to make a proton, two downs and an up to make a neutron. That's exactly what's needed to create matter as we know it, with the electrons then going around them in the right way, and the charges when masses work out. The universe is so fine-tuned. There has to be something behind it that made it that way.
Although you'd have to rewrite Genesis pretty significantly. In the beginning, there was dark upon the waters, and then there was this soup, and then you quarks go up and you guys go down, and it would be a very different story.
Right. It was written for very primitive people, but what I like about Genesis is it does say that there was a creation to the universe. Cosmologists, physicists at that time, from 1917 to 1929, when Hubble discovered the expansion of the universe, believed the universe has always been there. Well, Genesis tells us that it was created at a certain point. Now, is it 7 days or 6 days or whatever? Of course not.
What can scientists help people of the book do, and what can religionists help scientists understand if they share a little more?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I tried to trace in the book the history of religion and science, and to me, at the beginning, they were very close. Many of the early scientists were religious. Galileo, his daughter was a nun, and he never really tried to argue that religion was wrong. He just said, look, the earth rotates, and all the rest of the things he was discovering. And it's really the literal interpretation of scripture that gets us in trouble. In the 21st century, I'd like to see the scientist or the atheistic scientist really stay on what science is designed to do, which is to understand nature and not to jump to conclusions that are not warranted. If you look at data statistically, you can't really disprove that there's something beyond the universe. Some people call it God. Maybe we should let them do that.
One of the things you would learn in probably the first session of a science class in your undergraduate college career would be that propositions like why science does not disprove God does not constitute a proof for God. It may be the case that you can't disprove that there's a God, but that is not an argument for the existence of God. How do you deal with that?
Right. Despite what you may read in many sites on the internet, I'm not proving, nor do I pretend to prove, the existence of God. All I'm saying is I'm trying to point out that these very well-known atheists who claim science has proven there is no God. Science says so. The math says so. The equations say so. Physics says so. Biology says so. Look, that's just not true. That's where I stop.
How do you deal with this argument? And it's one of the arguments you talk about in your book, and it's very much in vogue right now as physicists grapple with the string theory and the question of dark matter, multiverses, that we live in the universe that we're in because basically we live in the universe we're in. We're a part of that universe. We can only see certain things. So our universe looks like this because it's the only universe we could ever possibly see. There may be a million other things out there, but we can't see them. That's just the way it is.
That's a compelling argument. If you stretch it further, it can really imply, it's called the entropic principle that, you see what you can't see. You live where you can live. We obviously can't live on Mars or Venus because that's where the conditions are right for us here. This universe is the right universe for us. Maybe there are other universes, but we have no way of connecting with them. But that argument that there are other universes and other possibilities, that's really the power of infinity. And I object to that in the book because to me it's very hard to talk about infinity. And once you invoke infinity, it's like monkeys typing Hamlet. Anything can happen, and you can prove that mathematically.
Do you believe in God?
That's a tough one. I don't believe in any God of the Western religions. I believe in some kind of a power underlying and extending beyond the universe. Does that power intervene in our everyday lives? That's hard to think that way because statistics proves that it probably doesn't happen. But in a sense, I like a lot something that a French physicist said by name of Zwirn. He said, our consciousness is much more advanced than those of dogs and monkeys. Can we really believe that there's nothing in the universe whose consciousness is greater than ours in the same proportion, let's say? And I believe in that. I believe there's a consciousness in the universe and the power in the universe that we haven't yet uncovered that you may choose to call God.
Why Science Does Not Disprove God. It's the title of the latest book from Amir Axel, who's the author of Fermat's Last Theorem. And thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Really, it was a pleasure.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.